Is it possible to change our present-day challenges by going into the past? Does the phenomenon of déjà vu leave clues that we've lived before? Do our past lives actually coexist with our current incarnation? I spoke with paranormal researcher and best-selling author Rosemary Ellen Guiley about these big questions and more, and about the release of her new book, Soul Journeys, Past Lives and Reincarnation. What she had to say was nothing short of intriguing. Talking about your recent re-release, I guess we could call it, of Soul Journeys. And this is an updated version of your 1989 book, Tales of Reincarnation, correct?
That is correct, Alexis.
Great. Now, before you go any further, I want to just make a comment here. This is very interesting to me. This is 2 decades ago that you wrote this book, Tales of Reincarnation, since the original release. Now, you told me, you and I chatted about a week or so ago, that there's definitely been an increased interest in the subject of reincarnation, and I found that very interesting. What do you think this is due to? Where is that coming from?
There are a number of factors involved, and over the course of my 30-year career in the paranormal and metaphysical fields, I've seen certain topics cycle through phases of popularity periodically. I think that's natural. But we have a lot of people, we have baby boom generation now who's well into middle age, and this is a time for introspection, for reviewing your life, pondering who you really are, have you lived before, what happens in the afterlife. These are all natural turning inward questions that people in midlife start asking. And, of course, then we have another factor that whenever we have periods of chaos and upheaval, we've had a lot of economic upheaval, a lot of global strife, people react to that by also trying to put daily life into a bigger context.
Mm-hmm.
And so interest in past lives is certainly part of that. I have always believed in reincarnation. Well, since I was a teenager, it was one of my first spiritual beliefs that I formed at an early age.
Mm-hmm.
It made total sense to me. And I wrote Tales of Reincarnation as an overview and introduction for the topic to acquaint people with the planet's history of reincarnation beliefs and some of the astounding cases that have been documented and investigated and validated over the years. The book also includes a lot of original material, and I include some celebrities in that,
mm-hmm.
as well as people from all walks of life. So what I did with Soul Journeys, the new title of the book, is I did update it. And a lot of it still stands as very good introductory material, but I added some new material to it as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that just came out.
I was certainly fascinated by some of the, quote, celebrity or well-known names that you cited in the book. We're going to get into that. I have a couple of questions, particularly about the incredible account of Jim Morrison's confidant and one-time band manager of The Doors, of course. We're going to get into that a little bit later, because that in and of itself, I think, warrants a book. That was simply intriguing to me. But I wanted to quote something from your book, actually from the back cover. I thought this was interesting. It says, "The past can change the present in dramatic and miraculous ways." And it says, "Learn how people from all walks of life are able to heal, empower, and change their lives through past life recall." So again, I think you made reference to this in the beginning. You said that there may be more of a longing to use past life recall today in the face of so many challenges, the economic upheaval, the social upheaval. I think that's what you were saying there, right?
That is correct. And whenever people feel in turmoil, like they're losing their moorings and they can't have as much control over their lives as they'd like, people look for ways to regain their equilibrium.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that past life recall has been well known for decades is healing the present and also paving the way for a better future. And we can do that literally by going into past lives, because a lot of the roots of issues that we deal with now and that we might deal with in the future have their origins in other incarnations.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, again, I keep thinking of the Jim Morrison story. I'm sure the audience is going to be like, get to that already, will you? Because it is so fascinating. You know, last week I posted an article on my site, Higher Journeys, in which I theorized that the interest might be due to some sense in people, some sense that people are getting that the Earth is about to reincarnate herself. You know, we've heard sort of loose references to that. I know Dolores Cannon has referenced that in her Convoluted Universe, at least her latest book, Book 4, that the Earth being a living being as well, having a consciousness as well, in this sort of transitionary point that we're in, may be rebirthing. And could that be sort of this longing for people to understand the concept of reincarnation?
We're definitely caught up in a global picture, a global cycle at this present time from a number of factors. From a geological perspective, we can see through plenty of evidence that the Earth has gone through cycles, and these could be considered cycles of lifetime.
Sure.
And we have now, you know, a lot of attention focused on 2012, and more and more people are coming to realize this is not the end of the world, but it does herald the end of a cycle. And so when you have a lot of people focused on an ending, there's always anticipation of a beginning.
Yes.
And so the way I'm looking at 2012 is as a doorway to a new cycle of planetary consciousness, human consciousness. We have, over the past few decades, evolved a whole set of issues that we have to deal with concerning the environment, weather, the natural things that the planet is going through, and as we increase as a global village, we have to reorient our whole way of living together.
Sure, I would agree with that. Well, since you brought it up, I guess I have to ask the question, since we're what, merely days away from the, you know, December 21st, 2012, what many are anticipating that something will happen. And I agree. I think there are a lot that understand it's not going to be the end of the world. But what are your thoughts? Do you think we're going to see any market change or some anomaly happen on that day, which is just days away?
I don't think we're going to have anything on a mass global scale. Surely every event of any significance is going to be parsed up one side and down the other and analyzed under a microscope just because it's this artificial doomsday. And the end of a calendar to me means nothing other than just when they ended the calendar.
Right, yes, that's true.
So I'm sure we'll have lots of interpretations on all sorts of things. But predictions for mass raptures, mass ascensions, mass catastrophes, invasions of alien beings, used by alien beings, I don't think any of those things are going to happen.
Sure. What about anomalies in the sky? Anything that might visually show us that some transitory situation is taking place?
It's not out of the question, but we also have to keep in mind that human beings can literally create a lot of phenomena,
mm-hmm.
just turning their attention toward it. And so if you have masses of people focused in a single direction, that can psychokinetically create phenomena.
That's an interesting
point. It has to be very focused, and it has to be a high number of people. What I think is happening with 2012 is that there's just too much chaotic thinking,
mm-hmm.
too many diverse opinions about what's going on.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Well, of course, before we got on, started our interview, we had a brief discussion about PK, psychokinetics, and how people can actually affect their environment with their thoughts and emotions. So I think that's a very interesting statement. I certainly think that, if nothing else, could perhaps trigger something. Let's hope that something is a good thing. So nothing catastrophic, of course. So just wanted to digress on that because everybody's sort of centered on that right now. But let's go into this. This was another interesting thing you touched upon in your book. You said that we live, this is a quote, we live with an overlapping dimensional realities. and that the fullness of our being is beyond our present comprehension. I think that some of our, quote, past life memories are time dimension slips in which we get a glimpse of our multidimensional self having an experience simultaneous to the life we are living in this particular reality. Now, this is an incredible view, and I think there are others in this field of research that have intimated what I think you're intimating here, is that what we're considering to be past lives in a linear fashion may actually be co-occurring. Can you give us some thoughts on that?
Actually, I think that that really is the case, that we are not dealing with a series of lifetimes in linear time
mm-hmm.
so much as lifetimes that are happening simultaneously, and there are complex relationships among all of these incarnations.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in this particular reality, we live in chronological time with the past, present, and future. So that's how we look at these other lives. The only life we have from our perspective is the one we're in now, and other lives in other time periods from our chronological perspective have to be past, present, or future. But from a cosmological perspective, if we live in the eternal now, which is what all of the mystical traditions point to, then there is no past, present, and future.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is happening all at once.
Mm-hmm.
At some point in our soul evolution, we probably have the ability, and it may even happen between lives as well, to appreciate the bigger picture. The circumstances that we're in now, we are best dealing with other incarnations and other time periods in our linear time frame. That's the easiest way to grapple with it. That a lifetime in, say, 1800s America is a past life, not something that's going on now in another reality. So most explanations of reincarnation that we have throughout history, they have this chronological structure to them. And I think that when we get into more advanced awareness, we see things much differently. It's simultaneous. But they all affect each other. And so healing one life is may have a healing effect on another life.
Sure.
How we experience that healing, whether it's simultaneous or in a concept of a present or a concept of a future, I think it just depends on where we are in any given framework.
Well, you know, that, as you talk about that whole idea of simultaneous time and so forth, it makes me think of, or the chronological time that we're living in, makes me think of the subject of teleportation. Those who have claim that they have been able to go back in time, but physically, literally transporting themselves to an earlier time, which would intimate that that is still happening. How does that correlate?
It's just another way of looking at a similar phenomenon, that the concept of teleporting yourself to the past from a multidimensional perspective is you just teleport yourself to another dimensional awareness where that event is happening. It's happening concurrently. From our perspective, it would be going into the past, but from another perspective, it's just going into another dimensional awareness.
That is so difficult for so many to get their arms around. I you know, and I consider myself such an open-minded person, and yet there's certain concepts that are really just so difficult to frame. Anyway, is it just...
Well, you know, you're right on that. And the thing is that we do have to live our lives and orient ourselves to a chronological time frame. And maybe at some time in the future, so to speak, our consciousness will have changed so much that chronological time will cease to exist.
Right.
Have another a structure for reality. But right now, we have to deal with past, present, and future.
Mm-hmm.
And for anybody to make any headway in evolving one's concept of soul and life journey, that's the best perspective and framework to approach it from.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Rosemary, we need to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to bring in very quickly the subject of deja vu. I know that you briefly mentioned that as well in your book. So let's take this quick break. We'll be right back.
Every life on Earth has the capability of knowing the world in a much more powerful way than what we've settled for. And Gaiam TV is there to support your journey into knowledge, awareness, and awakening. Our vision is to raise global consciousness by bringing viewers original interviews, inspiring films, and engaging series on today's most sought-after topics. We invite you to try Gaiam TV free for 10 days by visiting www.gaiamtv.com/CLN to claim your free trial. That's GAIAMTV.com/CLN. You won't look at your life or your world the same way again.
Great. Well, we're back. And at the close of the last segment, I wanted you to touch briefly on deja vu as it relates to what we've been talking about. You know, obviously deja vu is that experience of having experienced something, you know, literally and exactly as it may have occurred before. Does that phenomenon somehow intimate the validity of past lives or confirm the validity of past lives in any way?
Deja vu is one of those common ways that people tap into past life awareness. And there are critics who disagree with that, who say, well, it's just repressed memories that are coming to the surface. Deja vu is feeling like you've been someplace before, even though you haven't, or you've done something or met someone before. It's a feeling of familiarity without any reference, you know, any framework of reference. And I do believe, and this is well documented in the past life recall literature, that past life memories can spontaneously surface. And let's say, for example, that we had a meaningful past life. I might say meaningful. We have so many incarnations that if we could remember them all, we would just be absolutely overwhelmed.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So in any given lifetime here on Earth, there are certain lifetimes that are meaningful and significant to that life, and information from those lives can present to us at key points so that we can tap into something that then is relative to the life we're dealing with now. So say, for example, we had a meaningful past life in another country, and let's say I've never been to that country before, and I go there and visit a particular city, and everything is so familiar to me. I know where things are. I have a sense of having been there before, and yet I've never been there before. So the explanation for that familiarity is quite likely a past life spontaneous recall.
Uh-huh.
And those sorts of births can then be explored in more detail by such things as meditating on it, asking for information in dreams, doing past life regression, working with someone in a group or a one-on-one where you literally journey in an altered state of consciousness to that life and try and capture more memories from it.
Mm-hmm. I want to tell you a quick story. Speaking of the instantaneous past life recall, I recall a little over 17 years ago, my husband and I just celebrated our 17th wedding anniversary. We honeymooned in Egypt. And of course, we were extremely excited, not only about the wedding, but our trip to this far off land we'd never been to. And I had been working on a day job, an office job at the time, and had been telling one of the assistants that I would be honeymooning in Egypt. Well, Rosemary, she literally turned a different color. I mean, you could tell she was somehow emotionally affected by it and had all sorts of questions for me. And then she proceeded to tell me how she doesn't believe but knows, felt that she lived during that time. She literally broke down into tears just at me mentioning that we were going. And so I remember while there, my gosh, we had gone to so many different ancient sites. And I remember we had gone to a granite the quarry, and I had just picked up a small piece of rock, and I brought it back. I think I mailed it to her. I never heard from her again, and I somehow felt that she was so emotionally wrought even over my mentioning Egypt. It was just really interesting to me. I think that may have been my first indoctrination into, you know, people that people you wouldn't even think of. This was not the type of person that seemed to be into this sort of study. So I was taken aback when she reacted the way she did. But clearly, just to sort of support what you're saying, I think we do have that. I roused something in her when I brought up Egypt. And I've run into people on several occasions that have given me similar reactions talking about far off lands and believing they've existed there at some point.
These sorts of things can surface in so many unexpected ways, and it's not uncommon and certainly understandable to shrug a lot of that off as an odd coincidence or if there's some other explanation. But if we contemplate these experiences and examine them more fully from the standpoint of reincarnation, then a whole new set of information starts getting presented to us. And these things are like dominoes sometimes. Mm-hmm. You allow some information to penetrate, so to speak, in certain ways and start contemplating the idea of past lives, and then pretty soon more and more things start coming to you. Now, every spiritual tradition and religion on the planet has dealt with this subject. And even though in Christianity, this is not a tenet of Christianity,
right.
It was definitely discussed by the early church fathers. There were various concepts of reincarnation. And we find a lot of variety and a lot of ideas about what different traditions say reincarnation is. There are many possibilities, and in fact, there may be no one type of reincarnation. There may be many of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's good to at least be open to the idea.
Sure. Yeah. I do think, I agree with you. I think that these are subjective experiences in a large part, and that there may, in fact, be no template for how this occurs. In fact, you know, I think said in one of my, I'm doing a whole month at my blog on reincarnation. And in one of my pieces, I made mention of the fact that reincarnation, especially as it pertains to perhaps simultaneous lives, maybe should be called co-incarnation versus reincarnation, because they're different experiences for different people. I don't know. I do agree with you.
That's a very good term, co-incarnation.
Yeah. Yeah.
That really expresses the multidimensional concept much better than reincarnation.
Absolutely.
Implies a succession of lifetimes.
That's right. Sort of endorses that the linear aspect is the only aspect. So maybe there does need to be a reframing, and maybe there will be once we lose chronological time. But, well, listen, I want to get to, this is really exciting, and this is pretty substantive, so I want to spend a little bit of time on this before our next break. As you mentioned, you were able to interview several very well-known personalities about their own reincarnation experiences and some of the research that they've done, some of them. And one of them was the late author Michael Talbot, who many of you in our listening audience know I absolutely love. I think his work is just absolutely amazing, and I'm so sorry that he's not still with us. But I want to talk a little bit about that. He had some very interesting things to say about the imagination he used in some of his fiction works. And for some of you out there that may just be familiar with the holographic universe, which of course was nonfiction, he did both fiction and nonfiction. But he believed that some of the characters that he was bringing through in his fiction work were somehow derived from his own past lives. Tell us a little bit about his story, Rosemary.
Michael Talbot was a very unusual man, and I was very privileged to be acquainted with him for a short period of time. And as you mentioned, very unfortunate that he's not still here, very mm-hmm. creative and imaginative. And I do believe that fiction writers pull, they're visionaries. Fiction writers are visionaries, mm-hmm. and they pull from a variety of sources for their material. They pull from other realities. They pull from what we would say our future is, and they also pull from their own repository of lives as well, lives that we would call past lives. Now, one of the things that I also appreciated about Michael Talbot's approach to reincarnation was what he called the resonance method. And this is like a first cousin to deja vu, but it's the idea that the things that attract or repel you in this life have past life connections.
Mm-hmm.
So the skills and talents, the things that we gravitate toward wanting to do in this life, have past life threads. Things that we have phobias about, aversions to, fears of, are related to past lives. And by doing a catalog of your own resonances, you can begin then a process of identifying likely past lives, or at least time periods where you might have lived. And by following those threads, it's quite a process of self-discovery.
Wow. It's called the resonance method. And is this something that, Talbot sort of coined, this term?
That was the term he coined for it. And, you know, by all means, he wasn't the first person to say that, you know, our likes and dislikes are related to past lives. But he refined the process for resonances.
Mm-hmm.
And here again, this, like deja vu, this is something that you can meditate on. You can work into dream programming. Our dreams are a fabulous tool for digging up all kinds of information about ourselves and revealing all kinds of truths. We can work on our dreams. We can take resonances into a past life regression. For example, let's say that a person has an unusual aptitude to be an artist. And so it might be interesting and instructive and educational to explore what other past lives have I had where I was an artist and how did I gain these skills. You know, we're all born with some aptitudes and inclinations. Where do these come from?
Mm-hmm.
The whole idea of genius and artistic talent and skill, natural skills at things, they've all been wondered about by many people. Like, how do we get this way? Is it in our DNA? Do we get it from our parents?
Right.
So many cases where remarkable talent can't be explained that way. So where does it come from?
Mm-hmm.
An explanation is it comes from another life.
Right. Well, you mentioned, you know, when people sort of question where do these aptitudes come from, or even, you know, issues that are not necessarily positive, many people, we automatically think, oh, it's in our family, it's in our lineage, it's in our blood from that standpoint. But I think the more interesting question, does it actually come from previous incarnations?
And it's probably a combination of things. It's said that we choose our parents, and it may very well be the case, at least in some lives. And so we might choose, or ask at least, to be born to certain people who have some sort of background or talent or something perhaps in DNA, who knows, you know, what information we have available to us in the lives,
mm-hmm.
lives. But we may choose to be born in certain circumstances that that are going to enhance our ability to develop something that we'd like to develop,
mm-hmm.
you know, an activity. I even think that things concerning redemption play into it. The universe is compensatory. There's cause and effect. And this is the law of karma, too. And it could be that in some lifetimes, we seek out circumstances that enable us to redeem ourselves in some way.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you brought up karma, Rosemary, because I want to, when we come back, we're going to take a little break right now, but when we come back, I want to get into that as it relates to what I'm sure many of you are going to want to hear about, the story having to do with Danny Sugarman, who was a close confidant of the late Jim Morrison from The Doors. So let's take a quick break. We'll be right back, and we're going to get right into that on the other side of this.
In these changing times, the journey toward global consciousness has never been more important. GaiaMTV is the first online video library dedicated to supporting your journey toward global and personal discovery. Our viewers enjoy unlimited access to our vast selection of inspiring interviews, engaging films, and award-winning wellness videos. And we invite you to try it for free. Visit www.gaiamtv.com/cln to start your free trial. That's gaiamtv.com/cln. The journey starts now.
Okay, great. We're back and we're going to get into something that I, again, found so interesting. We're going to talk about karma relative to this as well, but I want to go back to Michael Talbot and how that segued into your introduction to a man by the name of Danny Sugarman, who, as mentioned, was a close confidant of The Doors' Jim Morrison. And I think at one point he was the band's manager. And as I said, this story is perhaps one of the most powerful in the book for me. There's a lot of ground to cover here. But, you know, what I want to first bring up is this intimation that there may have been a possible past life relationship between Michael Talbot, Jim Morrison, and Danny Sugarman. Could you give us just a glimpse of the story, Rosemary? And I know I'm asking a loaded question because it's meaty, but if you could give us a synopsis of this, I think that would be great.
Danny Sugarman, as he just mentioned, became very involved with The Doors, first as a roadie and then as a manager. And he was very young when he met Jim Morrison. He was like about 12 years old when he first met. And he idolized Jim Morrison, who was extremely bright, even brilliant. And he and The Doors certainly were part of a defining voice for a generation. Like a lot of musicians, especially in that era of the, you know, the 1970s, mm-hmm. 60s and 70s, I think The Doors broke out in the late 60s, there was a lot of alcohol and drug use. And we all know that Jim Morrison died of substance abuse at the age of 27.
Yeah.
And Danny Sugarman got into that as well. And he had a great deal of difficulty, which he even wrote about in his own autobiography later, getting clean, straight, and sober, and really struggled with that. But part of his rehabilitation involved looking into past lives, and this was suggested to him by a friend. While he was going through withdrawal from drugs, he found that acupuncture really alleviated a lot of his pain. And acupuncture also is a way that people often start to recover past life memories. But he decided to go into it, to take a look at it, and he recalled one especially powerful past life with Jim, where he and Jim and also Ray Manzarek from the band all shared a past life in an Asian monastery, ancient, which he felt had even been before the time of Christ. And it was a remote area, you know, it could have been like early Buddhist. And Jim was, Danny told me, he said, I don't know what the exact name is for it, but he was like the abbot. He was like the guy who ran everything. Mm-hmm. And Jim was in the process of dying in that life. And Danny had been sent there by his parents as kind of a reluctant novice. And there was some sort of teaching or wisdom about the use of hallucinogenic plants and properties, you know, chemicals, that Jim wanted to be passed on. And it had to do with issues of proper use and misuse. And he wanted Danny to take responsibility for this, these esoteric secrets, and safeguard them and make the proper use of them. this was a responsibility that Danny did not want, and he turned it down. And then decided that he was going to leave the monastery. So his feeling was that all of them were dealing with these things in another way in this life. They had all come together again. They were all grappling with misuse of drug issues. And it was like coming back around, full cycle, that he felt that, well, I avoided it in the past. I have to confront it now. And that's what he did. He had to meet abuse of drugs head on.
I'm sitting here speechless. Of course, I read this chapter. I'm going to read it again because this is absolutely powerful. The implications of you know, the meaning of if reincarnation exists and there is some meaning to it, this brings us again to the subject of karma. There is a relationship between his life along with Jim Morrison and this other gentleman that you mentioned, and having to do with this sort of secret knowledge that he didn't want to take responsibility for. I hope the audience is really getting the significance of this. It's difficult to sort of regurgitate, but yeah, this to me points to a karmic cycle. And somehow his being called to address the misuse of drugs or putting drugs in their proper context as a medicinal hallucinogen, which did he ever, Rosemary, reconcile that the misuse of drugs? Was he ever able to get healed in this
life? Yes, he was. Danny said that by 1984 he had healed himself of a drug abuse, and he passed away in 2005.
Mm-hmm. How old was he? Do you know? In 2005.
Let's see. Probably around 50.
Wow! Still young.
Very young, but he had been a heavy smoker. You know, most people in that industry are. Mm-hmm. And he died of cancer. He died of lung cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Michael Talbot,
yeah,
through an independent past life recollection, felt that he had been a monk in that same environment, that he had been there in that lifetime, and that that was one of the reasons why he had gotten to know Danny in this life. In fact, Michael Talbot was the one who introduced me to Danny.
Right. That's right. You mentioned that in the book. That's something. Well, let me tell you something for all of you listening out there. If there's any reason for you to want to now delve more into the subject of reincarnation as it can be a form of rehabilitation, look at what it did. Although we did lose Danny Sugarman still at a relatively young age, it seems like he used therapeutic past life regression to get to the core. And of course, it took a lot of sleuthing, a lot of contemplation on his part, but was able to get to the core of perhaps where this current drug addiction emanated from and was able to find some semblance of healing. If that's how powerful it can be, I say look into it. Pay attention to these things. That's very powerful, Rosemary. I thank you for putting that story in the book. And I think the whole book is phenomenal to me, and I can't wait to delve in again. But that, to me, is a very significant anecdote that you tell.
It is one of the most powerful stories in the book.
No question.
And it's exclusive, too.
Yes.
Danny gave me the whole story. He was very frank and honest. And it's very moving. Now, I did want to mention one other thing, and
please,
this was another way that he had closure on the subject, was he co-authored a biography on Morrison with Jerry Hopkins called No One Here Gets Out of Live, and it was a bestseller. And he felt that, that's what he had to do to honor Jim and kind of wrap things up to put Jim's own life into perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And he told me, he said, I think now that I've done just about everything I can for him. It was a debt that needed to be paid from a long time ago.
Wow. That's something. You know, there, admittedly, I don't, beyond the work, albeit short and short career that Jim Morrison I don't know that much about, or didn't know that much about his personality, but you even gave a glimpse into to that a little bit about how dynamic and seemingly old soul-ish Jim Morrison was, you know, at the tender age of what, in his young 20s, was his grasping of concepts that clearly someone of his age should not have had. Again, I think you do an excellent job of giving people a synopsis of how dynamic a person this was. His thinking was so incredibly mature. You know, he was a poet, right? And it sounds like he wanted to have his poetry taken seriously. He was just dynamic, but seen through the lens of psychedelic drugs, perhaps just put too heavy a lens on it. I don't know. Very interesting.
Well, he was one of these personalities, and we've seen a number of them in history. Their light is brilliant and bright, and it burns very fast, and it burns out very fast.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're a meteor, and that may be the path that they choose in this life.
Sure.
Stays very brightly for a brief period of time, but intensely. And then they're gone.
Yeah. That's an interesting, that could be an interview in and of itself. Let's move on a little bit. We're winding down. I can't believe this went by so quickly. We'll take a little bit more time, though, because I have a couple of things I have to get to. You talk about mirrors as it relates to reflections, insights that we may be able to get about past lives. Now, I've always had a fascination with the mystery of mirrors. I've always tried to understand what's the significance in the sort of mystical literature. But you go into glimpsing past lives and exercises that can even be done when gazing into a mirror. Can you talk about that just for a minute? And then I want to tell you a story about my mother who had an experience like that. But if you could just elaborate on that a little bit, the mirror phenomenon.
Mirrors are a very powerful tool, and they should be used carefully because the work can be unsettling for some people. But I've often recommended mirrors for a variety of spiritual path work studies. They have been considered in folklore since ancient times to be doorways to the spirit world, that they reveal truth. They are portals or openings that spirits can use to enter the present. And by gazing into them, we can transcend physical boundaries and time itself. So one way of using a mirror as a past life recall tool is to sit in a darkened or dimly lit room. It's a good idea to have a little bit of light. And you can gaze directly into the mirror and ask to see yourself in past lives. If you remain steady at it for as long as you possibly can, you may see your face change. And sometimes it can change quite dramatically.
Wow.
As I mentioned, this can be very unsettling for some people. So it's a good idea to be, you know, just very prepared that you might be startled by what you see.
Sure.
Now, another thing way you can use it is to position a mirror so that you and put the lights dim and position a mirror so that you can't see yourself directly in it and ask to see scenes from a past life. The best way to use that is to lay it flat on a table so that it's just looking up at like a ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like a blank surface, and ask to see scenes from the past. I also use black mirrors, and a black mirror is a very common scrying tool. Scrying is a term for clairvoyant gazing.
Right.
And the black mirror has, the inky depth of the mirror kind of pull you in. And it's often easier to see visions in a black mirror than in a silvered mirror.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have a black mirror, a flat screen TV will also work as well.
Interesting.
And you can position a flat screen TV that's off so that, you can just look into it in a dimly lit room and ask to see visions of the past or yourself in a key scene in a past life, or to hear a word or something illuminating about your past lives. And by gazing into a surface that begins to alter consciousness, that also triggers auditory stimuli. You might hear things, mental stimuli. You might get mental pictures. It becomes kind of a synergistic process where you're not always seeing something in the actual mirror, but you might be seeing it in your mind's eye.
Sure.
The act of gazing into the mirror that triggers that.
That makes sense. Well, I want to tell you, my mother, who, God bless her, has been gone well over a decade, my gosh, 15, 16 years now, I'll never forget. We used to talk about things like this, although she wasn't as passionate about some of these subjects as I was. She would every once in a while reveal these little incidents that happened to her. And one day she told me that she had a vanity in her, in the master bedroom, that I have to this day. And of course had a mirror sort of that would stand up. You could lift it up from the vanity. And she said she was sitting there one day just putting her makeup on. And all of a sudden she saw another face superimposed over her reflection in the mirror, and she was startled, of course. I don't remember much more than that, whether it was a male or female image, but she said unequivocally that another face showed up in the mirror as if it were her. I've heard other people make mention of this. Not a lot, but certainly enough to pique my interest. So
it can happen spontaneously, just like a deja vu.
That's right. That's right. So I think that's another fascinating thing. And I agree with you. I think mirrors are, they're very mysterious and sort of similar to how the Ouija board may be looked at as something to be used with extreme caution and respect. In other words, don't do this just because you want to see what happens. I think there should be some substantive impetus for wanting to do an exercise like this. But I do think it's definitely worth looking into for people that are looking to start that journey into past lives. I want to bring up this person. I think I'd be remiss if I didn't before we wind down, Rosemary, and that's Ian Stevenson. He, of course, who passed away in 2007, but was a pioneer in reincarnation research, in particular with past lives of children. He had some very interesting things to that were revealed about in his process for finding these children, finding out their stories, getting obviously permission from their parents, but hearing these compelling cases of these children who would repeatedly reference what they believed to be past lives. And the fact that he was able to corroborate the details of what this child was saying with the deceased person that he was able to find, I think that's just fascinating. Talk about that a little bit in his work, if you would.
Ian Stevenson was the leading Western researcher on reincarnation, and he investigated thousands of cases during the course of his career. He made no claims of proving reincarnation, but he said that many of these compelling cases where the evidence cannot be explained away naturally provide a powerful support there. It's evidence in support of the concept of reincarnation. The best subjects are children,
mm-hmm.
and other investigators around the world have found that to be the case as well, that if we are going to have a flood of spontaneous memories, they're most likely to happen in childhood. Children are like blank slates. They haven't acquired a lot of experiences and memories and things that get overlaid on top of us as we get older and older. They're highly imaginative. They're very open. And some children seem to come into a life with a lot of memories from another lifetime. Cases that Stevenson investigated had children who could identify by name where they had lived, who their family members mm-hmm. were. He had cases in his books about children who were then taken, if it had been like a recent reincarnation and those people were still living, even taken to meet those people, and he could recall things about them that he couldn't possibly know. Sometimes they talked about how they died. Recall in Western children tends to be much spottier. In other cultures where reincarnation is considered to be true and these sorts of connections are encouraged, those children seem to have a lot more detail.
Mm-hmm.
Not that Western children don't, but it tends to be repressed more, and just by parents who naturally say, "Oh, that's just your imagination."
Right.
Of course, he didn't live before. You know, isn't that silly? So children then stop talking about it,
mm-hmm.
and then those memories gradually fade. Stevenson said that between the ages of 5 and 8, the past life recall begins to diminish if it's been active in a child, and by age 8, the memory drop-off is quite dramatic. And that may be a function of just the aging process. You know, the older a child gets, the more socialized they become. They're learning social skills, interactions, they're going to school, they're learning how to integrate themselves into the world. So these take center stage,
mm-hmm.
and whereas in young children, they're more engaged in their imaginary worlds and in playing and bringing these things out. Stevenson stressed, and other researchers did too, that these recollections are not fantasy. They're not just imagination made up by children. Many of them can be verified with hard data.
Wow. I certainly hope, especially here in the West, that there will come a time where those of us in society that maybe heretofore poo-pooed these things will start taking a serious look at what these things have to teach us, because it seems like we're missing a big part of the puzzle if we don't. You know, on a more somber note, I think I would be remiss if I didn't make mention of, speaking of children between the ages of 5 and 8, this absolutely horrific tragedy that happened in Newtown, Connecticut, the shooting that took the lives of 20 children. And in fact, Rosemary, I know that you live very close to that area. These parents right now, I can't even imagine the shock and the disbelief that they're going through, not to mention so many other parents around the country, but in particular, the parents of these children, these little babies that are angels in the sky, we hope. It's still very raw, we know, and it's going to be for quite some time, but from your perspective, if there was any way that we could draw upon this wonderful information that we have in the world of spirit, if these parents could somehow reach these children, if only to find out they're just okay, is there anything that they could do? Not now, but in time.
There are many things that they can do, and I just want to add, my own sympathies for this mind-numbing act of violence.
Mind-numbing.
So
yeah.
Beyond comprehension.
Yes.
We saw from the moving service, it was the service where all the clerics from different religions spoke at the memorial service, and then President Obama spoke as well. So many faiths represented. So different faiths have different beliefs on
mm-hmm.
what the afterlife is like, what happens to the soul, whether or not the soul reincarnates. So the parents, of course, who are going to be working through their grief using their own faith as the center point. I have worked with groups of parents who are, bereaved parents struggling to cope with the loss of their children.
Mm-hmm.
And I've also worked with paranormal researchers who are probing ways of reaching into the afterlife. And from a general perspective, we find that a number of things happen. Sometimes there's spontaneous communication, more so from older children and adults than very young children, but it's not out of the question. And communication can be a synchronicity, a sign, a sense of a presence, even hearing a sound, even in your inner ear. And many of these signs are very comforting to people. They sense that someone is still near. Even if it's seeing something significant spontaneously, a sign in nature, or seeing something associated with a child that the child would have really identified with. Those things can happen spontaneously. And then there are some parents who actively seek for contact, for connection.
Mm-hmm.
And there are groups. There's a group called The Big Circle, which is an internet-based group. And it's not limited to parents trying to connect with children. It's anyone attempting to. It started out with parents looking for children, but it's expanded to anyone seeking contact with loved ones. And it involves electronic voice phenomena to join together in a collective group at certain times on the internet, and to have tape recorders running, the computer on, to ask for signs, for a voice, for some sort of evidence. And the evidence of communication is quite startling. There are many evidential audio clips available on the internet and stories of people who have had meaningful contact.
Mm-hmm.
And these are personal truths. You don't have to prove anything to anybody.
That's right.
Else.
Right.
And they can be profoundly reassuring.
Yeah.
So these sorts of things happen, and as the parents are working through their grief, they may experience one or more of these.
Right. Well, whatever it takes, if there's anything that can be done to reassure them, to calm them, to bring back some semblance of normalcy one day, and if it's through these channels or otherwise, let that be so. Let that be so. Rosemary, I thank you, as always, for a compelling interview. You never cease to amaze me. You just do extraordinary research, so I thank you again. Folks, go out and get this book, Soul Journeys, Past Lives and Reincarnation. And Rosemary, I'm sure this is available everywhere, but why don't you give us your website once again and tell us where else folks can pick up the book.
It's available at Visionary Living. The hard print is available at Visionary Living, and ebook is on Amazon.
Oh, good.
I'm in the process of getting the book into other ebook formats, and also it will be available on Amazon in hard print very shortly.
Very good. Well, folks, you know, there's not a bad book by Rosemary Ellen Guiley, but I got to tell you, you got to get this book. I think it just covers so much. It's a veritable source guide and plenty of anecdotes of people that have had these amazing experiences. So, again, Rosemary, I thank you so much. And have a great holiday. I can't believe it. We're, what, 10 days away or less?
Oh.
So thanks again, and we'll talk to you soon. Okay. According to Rosemary, this new age that we're currently living in will most certainly pave the way to new levels of understanding about ourselves and the true nature of reality. Exploring past lives is one powerful channel to achieve understanding that we've never had before. To learn more about Rosemary Ellen Guiley's work on this subject, and to pick up a copy of her book Soul Journeys, Past Lives and Reincarnation, visit her website at visionaryliving.com. For more great insights about this and other alternative subjects, make sure to bookmark ConsciousLifeNews.com. Thank you for listening to Conscious Inquiry.